Exception number 8843, rule number 2.
Gunscroop reel 2.
Unfortunately, that day a German bomber had been over and bombed the line. He had not broken the bomb had not broken the actual rails, but it had undermined the shingle under the rails. And the pilot engine went over it all right and didn't notice it. But when the brigade train, which is terribly heavy, I mean, it had heaven knows how many people on board, 3,000 people probably, and the whole thing turned over, and that was that. And it was 2 or 3 in the morning, and we all got out, and I tried to, Sierra said to me, get the troops fallen in, so I shouted at them, and they fell in by companies. And then the message came from brigade, you'll march to the Verma tunnel, and you must be there by daylight before the first German bombers come over. You see, they'd bombed regularly throughout the 24 hours, really. And we wanted to be undercover in the tunnel before they came over. You see, there's no question of the German land forces catching up with us. We'd blown everything. And it was some time before they eventually got to Verma. And anyhow, we set off. We were told it was 3 miles. After we'd been marching about an hour, there was no sign of this tunnel. And CO said to me, send the IO off. The only transport we had in the battalion was one motorcycle, on his motorcycle, to find out where the Verma tunnel is. And he came back and said, it's 3 miles, sir. I said, but it was 3 miles when we started. And go and find out again. And he went off, and he came back, and we found that the Norwegians were referring to Norwegian miles, which are 7 English miles. So we had 21 miles to march, and not 3. And, well, of course, we weren't there in time. It was light long before we got there. But the Germans, fortunately, didn't come over that morning, apart from 1-2 reconnaissance planes, and we got intact to the Verma tunnel. Where we stayed until the following night, when another train was ours was on its side, lying on its side somewhere, and we got in a train and went back to Ornesness, leaving again a couple of companies on top of the tunnel, because by that time the advance elements of the Germans had just caught us up by nightfall, and we got down there and. Again, the two companies followed, but the Germans followed them up hard, you see, because there were only 2 companies of them, and they were very close behind them, and around Ordnance, we had another 2 companies which were there to take over as the defence of Ordnance while we all embarked, and the two companies which had been in front came back through them, went straight down to the ship and got on board and went off. I suppose we went in, the brigade must have gone in 4 or 5 different destroyers and cruisers of various sorts. And my job as adjutant was to check in the last man at the gangplank onto the, it was a ship called an AK-AK gunship, the Calcutta. And the captain was getting very concerned. He kept coming to me and said, I've got to go, I've got to be clear of the fjord before first light, or I'll be caught in the narrows of the fjord and strafed. I must go. And I said, well, you cannot go, sir. My job is to stay here until the last greenhard is on board. And another 20 minutes, and the last man did come in, checked them all on board, and we steamed off, and there was no trouble of any sort on the way back after that. The Germans shot at the destroyer as he was going out, but he was only with small arms or machine gun fire. Did no damage. And after that, there was nothing once you were out of small arms range.
What time of the day did you pass through the Narrows, do you remember?
Oh, in broad daylight. Shouldn't have been, but it was. Because we were held up so much in breaking contact with the Germans, you see. But their aircraft weren't over in time to We were out in the open sea before they came, and they didn't follow us out to sea. They could have done, but they didn't.
Would the captain have had the authority to take it upon himself when to leave?
Well, his orders were to get clear by... so he cleared the Narrows by first light, but also to pick up the Green Howards, which meant the Green Howards, not leave 20 men behind or something. CO backed me up, of course, and said, no, we must wait for the last one to get in. And then we had another 24 hours from there, and we got to Scarpa Flow, and we got off the destroyers and things, and we got into a very luxurious transatlantic liner called the Lancastria, which incidentally came to grief a bit later. I think it was at Dunkirk, it was sunk. And we lived in great luxury for 3 days as we steamed very slowly around the north of Scotland and into Glasgow. We couldn't make out why we were going so slowly and why we couldn't go straight to Glasgow. Well, the answer to that was that General Ironside, who was, I forget what he was at the time, CIGS, I think, he came up to Glasgow. And he addressed the whole brigade in a big hangar before we entrained. And the gist of what he said was, you see, nobody knew in England by that time that we'd evacuated Norway or the south of Norway. It was only the Ormuzdes I'm talking about, not Namsos and Narvik further north. That went on much longer. In fact, while we were at sea on our way back, we heard it said on the wireless, on the news, that there was no truth in the fact that the British forces were withdrawing from the south of Norway, where we were already halfway across the North Sea by that time. And what Ironside had to say was that he said, now you're going home on leave, tell your families and everybody you meet that you fought the good fight in Norway, that you were overwhelmingly outnumbered and had to withdraw from it. But that we did so with our tails up, and it was a great success so far as it went, although you can't expect to win a war with one brigade of infantry against a large section of the German army with all supporting arms. Well, that was the gist of his what he had to say to us, and we went off on leave, and during that time all our equipment was new equipment was produced for us. We came out, of course, from Norway with all our small arms and personal arms intact, but there were certain things we couldn't carry over these long distances by foot, and there was a lot of equipment that had to be made up, you see. And we also had to get some transport. We had no transport in Norway at all, just one motorcycle, plus the train, the tame train, and a few lorries which had been impressed from the Norwegians, which took rear parties about.
How did General Ironside's speech go down with the officers?
Well, I mean, it was perfectly true. No comment on it, no criticism of it. It was true. It was delayed. You see, it was another day before it was announced on the wireless in England that we were back in England.
What mood were the men in when you got back to Scotland?
Delighted to be home, I think. Never thought they'd get back. I mean, there were such overwhelming odds against us. The chances of getting out seemed very remote for a time. In fact, we didn't know we were ever going out until we got back to Donbass and were told to head back to Ornelsnest, the port.
How did the troops get on with the sailors on board ship going back?
Oh, they're absolutely exhausted. I think they slept the whole way. Slept in it. I shouldn't think, though. Well, it's difficult to say, but everybody's thoroughly exhausted. You see, we'd had no real sleep for 6 days, and hadn't had much to eat. And it was a delight to get on this warship and have plenty to eat and plenty of sleep. I was terribly busy on the way back getting numbers, finding out all about casualties and all that sort of thing, because it was the first chance there'd been to check up on who'd been killed, who was missing, and try and get reports of what happened to them. Who all that was done on board through company commanders, of course. It's all collected from the company commanders.
Was there any suffering from the cold or weather conditions in Norway?
It was jolly cold. A few people sort of got frostbite, I think. I know, I went through the ice once trying to wade across the river, and my feet were wet for about 3 days. And I had no change of boots or anything. And my feet were in pretty shocking condition by the time I'd done a 21-mile march down to the Verma Tunnel after the train had turned over. But, no, the hardships weren't very, very great.
When you talk about the bad condition of your feet, do you mean blisters or what?
Blisters and, you know, if your feet are wet for long periods, they all get rather rotten, I suppose. I don't know. It was a long time before I could walk properly.
You mean skin peeling off? And
That sort of thing, yes. Yes, very uncomfortable.
What about sickness or injuries? Were there any of those? Sickness or injuries?
No sickness. A lot of casualties, of course. There were a lot of casualties in the train, but fortunately not my battalion. Brigade headquarters, who happened to be at the front of this train, when the train turned over, their carriage concertinaed and was sort of went like that. And they had quite a number of casualties. We didn't, though. We were further back in the train. We just turned over on the side, train inside.
You mean casualties in terms of broken bones or what?
Oh, yes, all sorts of things like that. Yes, broken bones, certainly.
Did you see much of the Norwegian civilian population?
Very little. They all went up into the mountains. There was nobody left in Otto when we first got there. There was nobody in Donbass when we got there. And I didn't have time to look in Orn's Nest, but I'm certain wasn't. It was a smoking ruin. No, the Norwegian population got out into the hills. They are very much better at moving in the hills than the Germans were, and they're much safer up there. We left behind our fighting patrol, which was about an officer and 25 or so. They'd been sent off in detachment up to a flank, and they were completely cut off from us, and we couldn't get the order withdraw through to them. They were under an officer called Tanner, Lieutenant Tanner, and he did very well with them because he moved them across country over the mountains. He saw the next day that we'd gone, you see, and the Germans were there where we'd been, and he'd no means of joining up with the battalion, so he headed for the coast. And it took him a number of days to do that, during which time he heard from the Norwegians what was happening on by listening to the English news, the overseas news, I suppose. And eventually got to the to a small fishing village, and he bought a fishing boat from a Norwegian. He signed an IOU on the British War Office for £1,000, which incidentally was paid by the British government much later, after the war, I think. But that £1,000 was paid. And he got back across the North Sea.
What do you think were the lessons of the campaign?
Well, we were totally unprepared for a campaign like that. Absolutely totally unprepared. And it's no good sending a token force to fight a very efficient army like the German army. They had everything, all supporting arms, masses of aircraft. They bombed us day in, day out while we were there. And we had a number of casualties from that, of course. But we were scattered, so the damage wasn't as bad as it might have been. But we had nothing. I mean, that's a lesson itself. It had to be done for, Churchill, who ordered British forces to Norway in support of the Norwegians who've been invaded by the Germans. And it's all we could do, to send a token force.
Do you think it did the Norwegians any good to have sent a token force?
Boosted their morale, I suppose. They felt we were on their side. And it may well have led to other things later on. When our troops went over there during the war and did various sabotage things against the Germans. They were very fine fighters, and all, they were very brave, and they were very good at that sort of sabotage form of warfare. And they paid for it as well. The whole villages got executed when something happened near them. One rather amusing incident occurred whilst the brigade was withdrawing from Donbass down to Åndalsnes. Whilst the brigade was in Norway, we had to take cash with us because, I mean, there were no pay corps people there, no other source of supply, and so we took money with us to meet the requirements of the brigade during the operations. And at that time, towards the end of the campaign, the staff captain had a cash box with about £2,400 in it, which he carried with him wherever he went. He slept on it, I think. Whilst we were waiting in the tunnel at Donbass before setting off for Åndalsnes, the Norwegian driver and firemen who were going to drive the train down to Åndalsnes were getting a bit restive and showing signs of wanting to disappear up the mountainside into the forests. And so the brigade commander detailed the staff captain, Captain Thompson, to stay on the platform of the engine and to draw his revolver and keep the Norwegian fireman and driver there, and if they showed signs of trying to go, to stop them. This he did, and it was all right, and we set off in the appointed hour from Donbass. As I've already said, the train ran into a bomb crater and turned over on its way to down to Åndalsnes, and at the time of the train actually turning over, the fireman was stoking the firebox of the engine. The cash box was on the floor of the cab, and as the engine turned over and came to a grinding halt, the cash box shot into the firebox and was completely destroyed. When we got back to England, the staff captain applied for this £2,400 to be written off and explain what had happened. And of course, the pay authorities in England wouldn't believe him, certainly at first. And I don't really think a lot of the troops did, because there were a lot of remarks by the troops of brigade headquarters to the effect, "Oh, Captain Thompson's going to have a wonderful leave this time. He's got £2,400 in his pocket." Which, of course, he hadn't. He was absolutely genuine, that. But I know the detail of this because I happened to take over as staff captain 2 or 3 months later. And when I took over the brigade headquarters imprest account, it still showed cash in hand of £2,400, which did not exist. And it was another 3 or 4 months before it was finally written off, and by which time we had convince the authorities that it was absolutely genuine and the money had been burnt. That's really all.